This week on Pirate Party Radio, Obama publicly backs the ACTA agreement. New Zealand has secretly been filtering the internet for months, and WikiLeaks leaks a story about itself declaring the site a threat to the U.S. military. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 20, for Thursday, March 18th, 2010.
What's more, we're going to aggressively protect our intellectual property. Our single greatest asset is the innovation and the ingenuity and creativity of the American people. It is essential to our prosperity, and it will only become more so in this century. But it's only a competitive advantage if our companies know that someone else can't just steal that idea and duplicate it with cheaper inputs and labor. There's nothing wrong with other people using our technologies. We welcome it. We just want to make sure that it's licensed, that American businesses are getting paid appropriately. That's why USTR is using the full arsenal of tools available to crack down on practices that blatantly harm our businesses, and that includes negotiating proper protections and enforcing our existing agreements, and moving forward on new agreements, including the proposed anti-counterfeiting trade agreement.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control points. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free speech, and patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for the links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And off the top of the show, the intro clip was from Obama's recent speech, which he included to aggressively protect intellectual property, and he publicly backs ACTA right there. I'm going to get into a news story later about that. That was set in by Weondi, and you can find the link to the full speech in the forums. We've got a whole bunch of incoming messages this week from listeners to the show. First one is, thank you for speaking up about ACTA. I signed up for a membership card today because of that. Cheers, Chris. Now, I'm guessing he's talking about signing up for a membership card to the Pirate Party. So good for you, Chris. Obviously, you're very interested in these things, and the Pirate Party is the party for you if you're interested in stories that I report on the show. And speaking of ACTA that he was talking about there, and what he was referring to last week, I didn't even talk about this. There was a thing for the Prime Minister. Stephen Harper did something on YouTube. He was asking for questions from the public, so I thought, why not throw something on there about ACTA from myself, so I could get him to talk a little bit about it, because I wanted to know where the Prime Minister stands with ACTA, because Canada is in talks within the ACTA agreements, one of the 11 countries currently participating in ACTA. So I made a little video. I'll link it from this show. No, I did get it in last week. Yeah. So I linked it last week on the show. And thanks to all the people, all the listeners that voted it up, it was ranked second in number of upvotes, number of people upvoting it for the video votes. There was a lot of text votes that got a lot more votes, marijuana questions, but for videos, it was number two for number of thumbs up. And actually, it had the most number of balance of positive votes. So if you subtracted the negative votes from the positive votes, it actually had the most out of all the video questions. So I want to thank all the listeners out there for giving it the big thumbs up, even though He skipped it and didn't answer the question, so we will still have to wait and see what the leader of Canada thinks about ACTA and where his stance is on it. We already know the U.S. president's stance on ACTA. He's fully supporting it, so we'll just have to wait in the coming days and weeks and months to see where Prime Minister Stephen Harper stands on that. The next one is from, I doubt this is airworthy, but I thought it might be of interest. Before installing the Garmin Communicator plugin, a piece of software for downloading data to a GPS unit directly from a website, I skimmed the end user licensing agreement and found the following paragraph buried at the bottom. This is number 12 from the agreement. Collection, use, and sharing of your information. When you download and install the product and the software, if applicable to your Garmin device, you will upload to Garmin from your device certain historical information that is stored on your device, including track logs. A track log consists of a list of spatial points and the times your device was at given spatial points, and information related to advertisements included with certain applications on your device, such as which advertisements were viewed on your device, how often they were clicked, blah, 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 blah. Advertisements, but it goes on, blah, blah, blah. By downloading and installing the product and the software, you consent to the collection, use, and sharing of this information in accordance with this paragraph in our privacy statement. And he goes on to say, after seeing this, I rechecked the end user license agreement on Garmin's map source, which came with my GPS and I already installed, and confirmed that its end user license agreement does not include such a paragraph. I wish I could say that I found this fact reassuring. Keep up the good work, Jay. P.S. Garmin's privacy statement, garmin.com/product/privacy, is actually worth a glance, particularly the part about personally identifiable information. And he goes on to list where that is located. So that is very interesting that the Garmin Communicator plugin is transferring information back to its home company of places that you've been. Why do they need to know where you've been driving around? What kind of information are they interested in? And they're able to share it with other people. You give the consent to the collection, use, and sharing of this information. How private is your data? How private is the information of where you drive around to? Is it being shared on the net? Is it being sold off to the highest bidder? And we're going to go into a story a little bit later involving MySpace and the data collection with MySpace being sold off. Another email that's come in, software for secure password storage. Now, I was talking, I think last week or the week before, about how to store all the different passwords that you have for websites that you go to, for banking sites, and just normal everyday forums and things that you log into on the internet, and how to keep them safe. Because if you use the same password for every site, one of these places, like what happened with the founder of Facebook, was found accused of using passwords that people have typed into Facebook and typing them into other places to gain access. Now, so we want to keep all your passwords different to each site, but now you've got a whole bunch of collection of passwords that you have to remember. So he sent along a link. This is from DJ, and he says it's also open source, which gives a little bit of reassurance that you know what the program's doing. It's not transmitting this data back to a home location like Garmin's doing. It's at passwordsafe.sourceforge.net, and he says it runs on Windows. I don't know if there's any other builds for it that can run on OS X or Linux, but you can take a look at that. Maybe you can do a build yourself for your operating system since it's open source. Can also run on Windows from a memory stick. No local install needed. So that's also reassuring. So you can take these passwords along with you. Don't lose the stick. Make sure that's encrypted or has a very strong password on it as well. Thank you, DJ, for passing along this information. I'll post that on the forum so everyone else can take a look at it as well. Another email. I was listening to your recent broadcast and was rather surprised by color copyright. I just mentioned that offhand when I was discussing one of the stories. As a great example, there is a copyright on the color pink, and another they define as cultured stone by the company Owens Corning. See owenscorning.com/copyright.html. What surprised me more was this supposed copyright of my little sister's favorite color has been owned by them and since 1964 under the mother company that owns them. So, quote, the Pink Panther and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios Incorporated, all rights reserved. I would love to see whether or not Barbie Co. would like to battle with them and see if they can get the rights to the shading on my sister's pigtail ribbons and glossy plastic jewelry. Thank you for everything you do. That's from Matt. Yes, there is copyright on certain colors. Certain mixing of pigments and different levels of colors, yeah, they're copyrighted. So if you use that color on something and you sell it and it matches their copyrighted color, yes, a spectrum of visible light, you're going to get in trouble. Somebody owns that spectrum of visible light. Sorry. Another email. Here's a personal story I thought you might be interested in about the low-tech side of anti-piracy in the UK. My parents go around the country, and this is from Patient Zero. Somebody who's involved in the rant community. Parents go around the country selling antiques and collectible items. Very boring work that I stay well away from. But on occasion, I'll lend a hand to help them carry your heavier loads and set up their stall. Last time I did this, I got talking with a girl who looked very out of place. Somehow, facial piercings and neon hair just stand out in a crowd of khaki pants and tweed jackets. We got talking about music. Turned out she liked a lot of the same stuff I did. So we got a good rapport going, and the conversation drifted over to the music I make. I played her some of it on the worn-out stereo in the van, and she liked it. So I ejected the CD, apologized for the shoddy marker doodle CD label, and handed it to her. At these fairs, there's often a police presence, looking for anyone selling contraband, illegal firearms, deactivated antique firearms are common, and such illegal items, including pirated media. No sooner had I handed over the CD than I felt a hand on my shoulder, an alarming "excuse me, sir," from behind. They thought I was selling her illegally copied media. I tried to explain that I had actually made the music I was giving her, and I owned all the rights to it, but they refused to listen, even when she told them that she didn't give me any money, and my parents, both looking very professional and upstanding citizens, confirmed that I had indeed made the music I was giving her. The only solution I could find was to take back the CD and instead write down where she could go to download the music instead, and the police still weren't happy about that. Luckily, I suppose, after a lot of accusing looks and frowns, I got away with a warning and told not to do it again, and they went on their way. I bent down to tie my shoe and dropped the CD in her pocket once they had left. I don't know if I should be flattered that they thought my music was worth stealing, or appalled that even when you're sharing something you made yourself, and you can prove that you did, you're still assumed to be a criminal. I chose the second option. So that was from Patient Zero. He has awesome industrial electronic music. If you want to go check him out, look for Patient Zero on the internet. That really is the default way of thinking nowadays, that only the special people make music. Only the people that are under the corporate cartel of the music publishers are the only people who actually make music that people would want to listen to. People are very ignorant to the fact that there are independent artists and that people are giving out music for free. Music is something that is to be shared, not something that's to be hoarded away or locked in behind a vault. And this is a great example of the attitude of music about music today, that it's something that can't be shared, is not allowed to be shared, even in you can't make it yourself, and it's a very scary kind of proposition. If you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form, and you can get a hold of me. An opinion piece that's written by me. So I saw Alice in Wonderland last night. This is literally last night I saw it. After the movie, I felt a little guilty. Not because it was a pretty bland movie, but because I gave money to one of the largest corporate proponents of copyright extension. But at the same time, the movie shows the importance of having the availability of public domain works. It's a great example of what can be done with media after its copyright has lapsed. It's just hard to reconcile the hypocritical stance that Disney takes when dealing with their own creation as opposed to someone else's. They have no problems enjoying the benefit of building new works based on old ones, but won't let others enjoy the same benefits with a certain mouse. The mouse is now currently 82 years old and won't be available for public use until 2023. 95 years after his first cartoon was released. In essence, this means that when you reach the ripe old age of 95, you'll be able to create new works from the things that were made when you were born, and not have the fear of being sued. I don't know about you, but when I'm 95 years old, I don't think I'll be in a position to create much of anything. Now let's get on to the news. In pirate news, copyright news from the U.S., Obama sides with the RIAA, the MPAA, and backs ACTA. And thus, our true colors are revealed. Since Obama was the young newcomer, technically savvy, many of us were hoping that he might support patent and or copyright reform. In case our story earlier on the subject didn't already tip you off, this certainly will. Obama has sided squarely with the RIAA and MPAA lobby and backs ACTA. No copyright and or patent reform for you American citizens. Obama made the remarks in a speech at the Export-Import Bank's annual conference in Washington. "We're going to aggressively protect our intellectual property," Obama said in his speech. "Our single greatest asset is the innovation and ingenuity and creativity of the American people. It is essential to our prosperity, and it will only become more so in this century. But it's only a competitive advantage if our companies know that someone else just can't steal that idea and duplicate it with cheaper inputs and labor. There's nothing wrong with other people using our technologies. We welcome," Obama continued. "We just want to make sure that it's licensed and that American businesses are getting paid appropriately. This is why the U.S. Trade Representative is using the full arsenal of tools available to crack down on practices that blatantly harm our business. And that includes negotiating proper protections and enforcing our existing agreements and moving forward on new agreements, including the proposed anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. It seems that the RIAA, MPAA, and similar organizations have been successful in lobbying the U.S. administration into supporting their cause. This means that the U.S. government will continue to financially support an industry that is simply outdated and has failed to adapt to the changing market, which seems remarkably anti-capitalistic and anti-free market, even for a Democratic president. Luckily for us Europeans, the European Parliament has already shot the ACTA agreement down in an overwhelmingly 633-13 vote, while also forcing total openness, something that the U.S. does not want. This means that despite Obama siding with the content providers, ACTA will most likely not come to fruition. Sadly, also this means that American consumers will continue to see their rights eroded as corporations and content providers further gain influence within the government. This means that devices you buy will not actually be yours, that uploading a video of your daughter dancing to the song on the radio could cost you thousands of dollars in damages, and it will also most likely mean that the three strikes law will be enacted. So that was the referencing the quote off at the top of the show with Obama siding with the ACTA agreement. And I can almost put in agreement that that's all they have in the U.S. now that they export is ideas and information, because they don't make anything anymore. They import everything. But I think that's maybe the wrong way they're going around it, by just suing everyone into the floor and throwing people in jail and cutting off the internet for people that are violating copyright infringement. They need to find a way to embrace it and innovate, because, you know, people are just going to get around it. You're not going to stop the majority of the United States population from doing what they think is right. Remember what you were taught in kindergarten. Sharing with other people is good. Censorship news from New Zealand. New Zealand internet filter goes live, and the government forgets to tell the public. Sent in by Weandi. New Zealand's internet filtering system went live last month, But the government forgot to mention to its electorate that until its hand was forced by an online freedom campaign, Tech Liberty. Thomas Beagle, a spokesman for the group, said he was very disappointed that the filter is now running and that its launch had been conducted in such a stealthy mode. He added, "It's a sad day for the New Zealand internet." In an interview with Computer World this week, he claimed that the filter had gone live on February 1st, but the Department of Internal Affairs delayed announcing until it had met with its independent reference group. The manager of the DIA's censorship compliant unit, Steve O'Brien, denied that there had been any subterfuge. The system had been undergoing trials for 2 years, and the media had been aware of this throughout. He said the independent reference group had met and the filter system processes were demonstrated as set out in the code of practice. That is, the website filtering system prevents access to known websites containing images of child sexual abuse. Well, the DIA continues to be coy about exactly which ISPs are joining the filter. Tech Liberty understands that Watchdog and MaxNet have already signed up to deploy the filter system, and that ISPs Telstra Clear, Telecom, and Vodafone said they will do so. Oricon, Slingshot, and Natcom had said that they won't, or in case of Oricon, that more data is needed as to how the filter will impact customer service. ISPs also appear to be taking a different views of what and when to tell their customers. MaxNet appears not to have warned their customers officially that the filter is in place. Vodafone has said it will do so when it goes live. The system employs the Swedish NetClean white box content filter. Website requests are filtered by Border Gateway Protocol against a blacklist held on a central server in the government's censorship compliance unit. The list is maintained by the independent reference group, which actively reviews banned URLs each month to eliminate false positives. Bans must be justified and signed off by 3 warrant inspectors of publications. Government statistics published in 2009 suggest that the blacklist include more than 7,000 URLs featuring child sexual abuse, or over 10 times the number of links recognized by the UK's Internet Watch Foundation. It has been built by the censorship unit since 2005 and is affiliated with Europe's COSPOL Internet-related child abuse material project. So that is very interesting that they never told New Zealand that it actually went into effect. And there's a good list of ISPs here that people maybe should switch to in New Zealand. Oricon, Slingshot, and Natcom. Hopefully those are nationwide ISPs that people can take advantage of and make the choice with their dollars, and let it be known that those ISPs that have put censorship in place, that have this blacklist in place that could be faulty, who knows what's on this list, because they're not going to tell you what's on this list. And I'll get to that in the next story. More censorship news from New Zealand. New Zealand relies on BGP router protocol to filter the net. Now this gets more into the technical aspects of the filtering system, the censorship system, as they even call it, what censorship compliance unit. This is sent in by Mind Inversion. New Zealand's government-run internet filtering system is now running, and 2 ISPs are already using the system. 7,000 websites are on the list, most dealing with child sexual abuse, bestiality, and other illegal content as classified by the country's official censors. You too can be a censor for a day. Such material has been illegal offline in New Zealand for years, so the expansion of the program to the internet isn't a big surprise. But will it work? The government runs the filter, but ISP participation remains voluntary. Currently, MaxNet and Watchdog are confirmed to be used the filter, though other ISPs are said to be interested. MaxNet CEO John Hanna explained his company's position to Computer World's New Zealand. "Filtering out child pornography is also very much in line with our company values. Our customers would be disappointed to hear if we weren't participating. So participation for us has always been a no-brainer." The filter uses a BSD Unix-based appliance called Whitebox from a Swedish company, NetClean. "We protect children on the internet." The government runs the filtering server and maintains the block list, which it advertises to ISPs using the Border Gateway Protocol. ISP routers then know what the best routing path the blocked addresses run through the government's filtering servers. All other requests route through the conventional internet as usual and are never scanned or logged by the government. Because an ISP address can host many domains, requests to block IP addresses are analyzed by the white box using deep packet inspection rather than being blocked outright. If the requests are for non-problematic URLs, they are forwarded on. If they go to a banned site or link, they are blocked and the user's IP address is logged. And a block message appears on the screen. Now, I want to pay you to pay close attention to that statement. The user's IP address is logged, so they know that you have gone to that blacklisted site. Now, maybe they're going to be sitting you down in a dark room with a bare light bulb swinging from the center of the room with a piece of paper with that IP address on it and the URL on it and your name, asking you, why did you go to this website? Are you a filthy person? Why are you looking at these pictures? When in reality, it may not be you. It may be your open Wi-Fi. It may be that you clicked on a tinyurl.com link in the IRC, unbeknownst to you where it goes to. It could be that you clicked on a website that's been hijacked. It could be anything. But now, you're on a blacklist in the government's storage chambers, waiting to be brought up the next time they want to get you in trouble. I'll go on. It feels pretty amazing that a country located on the other side of the globe turns to us, a small company with 22 co-workers in Gothenburg, to install blockage of child sexual abuse content, said NetClean CEO Christian Schoberg last year when the system was being tested. We're very pleased with the positive results in New Zealand, but Tech Liberty New Zealand, a civil liberties group, is less pleased. The filter handles HTTP traffic, useful but quite limited. As Tech Liberty's Thomas Beagle points out, the white box can make it hard to access forums and search web search sites, but it misses all sort of other things, as do most filters. The filter can't intercept encrypted web traffic. It's not hard to change your website from non-secure HTTP to secure HTTPS. The filter can't intercept the file sharing, email, chat, internet, instant messaging, or any other unencrypted web traffic, although it does intercept people accessing those services via websites. Adding new entries to the filter is a manual process. When websites are so easy and quickly set up, we don't see how it's possible for them to do a good enough job to keep the filter list up to date. And also, the filter will also be used, only be used by some ISPs. If a number of major ISPs don't use the filter, is there any point in implementing the ones that do? So this is a list of why it's a pointless exercise to implement this database and pay for it. In essence, the ISPs are shelling out money to put this into place. Why are they doing that? What is their incentive to put this into place? What are the benefits to their users? If a user is typing in a URL and they go to it, they want to go to that URL. Or if they accidentally go to that URL and they see something that they don't like, they go away from it. It's that simple. If they're seeing something that they do like, they are going to it, and you're not going to stop them. The people that want to go to it will eventually go to it through one of those means that they're not blocking already, and there's always a way around. Stop wasting your time doing this. Stop wasting your money. Stop wasting the user's money. And there's also stuff that they don't mention that what if a site goes on there on the blacklist? That's not supposed to be on the blacklist. Somebody complains about it. They make a typo, and all of a sudden, your website is down because it's named the same as something else. There are big pitfalls in this kind of censorship, and it is censorship. It's blocking out things that the government doesn't like. And what if ACTA goes through? And what if the large record companies don't like a website and they want it added to the blacklist? Well, the country is in agreement. New Zealand is on the list of negotiators with the ACTA agreement. Now, what if they incorporate all these websites into their blacklist? It's a slippery slope of blocking websites indiscriminately that corporations don't like. And maybe the government doesn't like dissident voices talking about opposing views that the government doesn't want you to read. Anything can happen once a blacklist is in place. And I'm very surprised that places like New Zealand and Australia want to put this in place and add to the growing list of countries that put blacklists in place, like China and Iran. Very strange that they want to be bedfellows with those other countries. Copyright news from Norway. This is actually good news. Centered by DC. Pirate Bay legal action dropped in Norway. Copyright holders have given up on legal efforts to force Norwegian ISPs Telenor to block file-sharing site The Pirate Bay, one of the parties close to the case said. The copyright holders, led by Norway's performing rights society Tono, and by the International Federation of Phonographic Industry Norway, IFPI Norge, Norway has lost two rounds in their Norwegian court system, and now has decided against appealing the case to Norway's Supreme Court, organization said. The goal was to see if that under Norwegian law is possible to order an ISP to block access to the Pirate Bay, and two clear court decisions have now said that is not the case, according to Tono. Spending more resources on the case would be, at this point, a waste, according to the IFPI. The copyright holder's interpretation of the court's verdict is that Telenor contributes to the Pirate Bay's illegal acts. But the action is not itself illegal in Norway. This, the organization said, raises the question of whether Norwegian law adequately implements the European Union Copyright Directive, a matter they would like Norwegian legislators to look into. Although Norway is not a member of the EU, it has agreed through its membership of the European Economic Area to implement certain EU directives in national legislation, including the EUCD. The battle between Telenor and the copyright holders started in February last year, when Telenor received a letter from copyright holders, including IFPI and Tono, demanding that it block access to the Pirate Bay. Telenor has, through this process, maintained that there is no legal basis for any ISPs to act in the interests of digital intellectual property rights holders by blocking individual websites. ISP blocking sites does not solve the problem of illegal file sharing. It just moves the problem elsewhere, according to Telenor. Now, Telenor is taking the right stance here. Telenor is not responsible, or any ISP is not responsible, for what you do on the internet. Kitchen knife manufacturers are not responsible for you stabbing your next-door neighbor. It's a tool. The internet is a tool. How you use it is up to you. If you're using it for illegal acts, then the act is illegal, not the ISP. They're not a facilitator in the act. They're giving you access to the whole internet. They are not the police for the copyright holders. They're not a police for anything. The police are the police. Don't hold the ISPs accountable for what you do on the internet. You're a big boy. You can do what you need to do on the internet. There's no need for the ISPs to step in and take that role. They're a company that does not need to take the burden on of looking at every packet that you send on the internet. It's completely unreasonable for the ISPs to do this. This has not taken place over telephone lines. It's not taken place over fax lines. This has not taken place over cell phones. None of these have been implemented on any of these electronic mediums throughout the last 100 years. Why should it take place on the internet? It is just another tool that is to be used. It doesn't make any sense on telephones, and it doesn't make any sense on the internet. Censorship news from the U.S. Secret document calls WikiLeaks a threat to the U.S. Army. Sent in by D.C. WikiLeaks presents a threat to the U.S. Army and publishes potentially actionable information for targeting military personnel, according to a classified intelligence report posted Monday on the whistleblowing site. The 32-page report entitled WikiLeaks.org, an online reference to foreign intelligence services, insurgents, or terrorist groups, indicates the government's concern that current employees or moles within the Defense Department or U.S. government are providing sensitive or classified information to WikiLeaks. To stop this, the 2008 report suggested a campaign to expose or punish those who leak to the site, which was founded in 2007 by Chinese dissidents, journalists, and mathematicians. WikiLeaks.org uses trust as the center of gravity by assuring insiders, leakers, and whistleblowers who pass information to WikiLeaks.org personnel or to post information to the website that they will remain anonymous according to the report. The identification, exposure, or termination of the employment or the legal action against the current or former insiders, leakers, or whistleblowers could damage or destroy the center of gravity and deter others from using WikiLeaks.org to make such information public. The document is a classified secret and was produced by the Army Counterintelligence Center under the Department of Defense Intelligence Analysis Program. It appears to underscore the military's alarm that WikiLeaks might be used to reveal the United States military secrets or broadcast disinformation harmful to the U.S. Neither WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange nor the Defense Department immediately responded for comment. The report, which could not be independently verified, said WikiLeaks could be of value to foreign intelligence and security services, foreign military forces, foreign insurgents, and foreign terrorist groups for collecting information or planning attacks against the U.S. forces, both within the United States and abroad. So this is a very good example, well, of irony, and of also don't shoot the messenger. If you're having lapses in your security, take a look at the security, not the person who tells you about the lapses in your security. It's just like a website that gets hacked, and somebody tells somebody that the website got hacked and how to fix it. They go after the person telling you how to fix it and the person that reported it, rather than fixing the problem. So that's really what they need to concentrate on, is fixing their lapses in security and doing a review of their security protocol, rather going after the site WikiLeaks.org. WikiLeaks.org is an incredibly valuable resource to the world, exposing the evils, really, of countries and corporations that are, doing subversive things. And it's a great resource and something to be proud of that is running on the internet. It shows what's happening in other countries and shows what is going on and what evil is happening in terms of censorship and shutting down, the rights of people. So it's a very worthwhile website to go and take a look at it. And they need your support. So go to WikiLeaks.org and check out what it's all about. Privacy news from the U.S. While Facebook and Twitter sit on the sidelines, MySpace jumps into bulk user data sales sent in by Mind Inversion. MySpace has taken a bold step and allowed a large quantity of bulk user data to be put up for sale on startup data marketplace InfoChimps. Data offers includes user playlists, mood updates, mobile updates, photos, events, reviews, blog post names, and zip codes. Friend lists are not included. Remember, Facebook and Twitter may be the name of the game these days in tech circles, but MySpace still sees a billion user status updates posted every month. Those updates will now be available for bulk analysis. The user data is intended for crunching by everyone from academic researchers to music industry information scientists. Will people buy the data and make interesting use of it? Will MySpace users be okay with that? Is this something Facebook and Twitter ought to do? The MySpace announcement raises a number of interesting questions. The 22 sets of data is being made available are cheap. Prices range from $10 for a raw dumps from the MySpace API to $300 for everything, broken out by latitude and longitude. Subsequently derived data sets can be put up for sale by InfoChimps users as well, with a revenue split. Analysis coming from the data could include things like music trends per zip code, popular URLs being shared, etc. MySpace is generally thought of as a social network on the decline, but if it's able to position itself as a place to do music still, then its hundreds of million users could remain engaged. Will data scientists want this data, though? Time will tell, but MySpace has long done cooler things with data than competitors Facebook and Twitter, and people haven't gotten terribly excited about it yet. Blah, blah, blah. It reads more like an ad for buying it. But this concerns me greatly, because if you do go to MySpace, are they offering every single person's piece of data from MySpace? Because some people's accounts you can't have access to unless they grant you access to. You can't see their photos unless you let them let the other person have access to them. You can't see their updates. So will this allow everybody to see everybody's thing? So where's the privacy gone? Was there no privacy to begin with? Is all your data going to the lowest bidder or highest bidder? It's not even a bidder. It's just available for the public. I could go and buy it if I want for $300, which tells me where you live, broken up by latitude and longitude, it says, and all your updates forever. Wonder if this includes things that have been deleted, too. It doesn't really go into detail. I wonder how what kind of information is going to come out of this as people do sign up and buy this kind of data set. And is Facebook going to be next? Is your favorite place going to sell your data when, in fact, you signed up for it and you didn't expect this kind of thing to happen? Of course, when you read through the end user license agreement or the online privacy statement, they say pretty much that your data is free and open, most of these places. So expect this to be coming more and more in the coming years as more of these social networks decline and go out of business because, you know, nothing lasts forever. Something that's hot 1 year could be not hot the next year, and then all your data gets sold off. How do you feel about that? Your data just being sold off after you thought it was private. All these settings on these pages on Facebook and MySpace are all for naught. You can click all you want, but it's still going to get sold in the end. Copyright news from Spain. Peer-to-peer file sharing legal in Spain. Sent in by DC. Spain is becoming the last bastion of common sense when it comes to peer-to-peer file sharing. At least until the big media companies get their own way and change the law in the country altogether. Torrent Freak, the ever-vigilant blog posting focusing on BitTorrent and file sharing issues, point to a recent lawsuit in Spain that ended quite favorably for both P2P users and link sites and dedicated search engines that found both use cases to be perfectly legal in the country. The subject of the lawsuit isn't particularly important in the grand scheme of things. A fairly small eDonkey and BitTorrent link site called ElrinConDeJesus.com was sued almost a year ago by local music industry groups. The SGAE, I won't try and pronounce the actual name of it, for alleged copyright infringement on the site. The group initially tried to get a court injunction on the site to take it offline before a full hearing on the case, but the request was denied by the presiding judge, Raul N. Garcia or Jejudo, claiming the P2P networks by themselves didn't violate copyright law. Yay, because it didn't. There's no files on there. The case went to court, and after a somewhat lengthy process, the judge was ready to make a decision. Unfortunately for the SGAE, not the one in its favor. The judge believed that just linking to content that might be infringing wasn't a violation and was not the same as distributing that content. He also noted that the law in Spain at the moment allowed this kind of sites to operate. That's something as well. Just because something is listed as the latest and greatest movie, say something was listed as Alice in Wonderland torrent, unless you actually download the whole thing, how can you even verify that that's the actual movie? So all these large corporations would actually have to go through each movie and download it to make sure that it was infringing and it was a copyright infringement. But even then, the site has no data on these movies. It has no data at all. It doesn't store these movies. So congratulations on that judge for seeing through the crap that SGAE was trying to propose. In the country, file sharing is pretty much legal as long as there aren't any financial benefits for either party. This also weighed in on the judge's decision as the site didn't have any advertising or any other form of revenue directly related to linking to the files. The judge did not only declare these type of sites to be legal, but he also reiterated that the individual users downloading copyrighted material from P2P networks for non-profit reasons were also legal in Spain. And there's the key, non-profit. If you're not making any money from this, he sees it as okay. You're just sharing. You're not selling somebody else's work. You're sharing a movie that you like or music that you like with your friends online or with other people that are interested in it online. You're not making money off of it. You're not profiteering off of it. No money is actually being lost. They're not spending money on it that they don't have. They don't have money to spend on it. We're going to go over that a little bit later in a story that's mentioned. Copyright news from Canada. Canadian MP introduces the $75 iPod tax. Charlie Angus proposed amendments to the Copyright Act that will ensure artists are getting paid for their work. and that consumers aren't criminalized for moving their legally obtained music from one format to another. The so-called iPod tax is resurfacing in Canada with news that the New Democratic Party MP Charlie Angus has introduced a pair of proposals to amend the country's Copyright Act. One would extend the private copying levy, first established back in 1997, I actually remember this, to portable media players like iPods, specifically C499, since the tax will cover any device that contains a permanently embedded data storage medium, including solid-state or hard disk, designed, manufactured, and advertised for the purpose of copying sound recordings, excluding any prescribed kind of recording device. This would finally give consumers some much-needed control over legally purchased products while simultaneously opening up new revenue stream for artists in the downloading age. Artists have a right to get paid, and consumers have a right to access works, he said in a press release. This is what balanced copyright is all about. The government has declared their intention to update the Copyright Act. If they're serious, then we need to update elements of the act like the copying levy and fair dealing. Now, this is a very interesting proposal in Canada. It's almost like a welfare system for musicians, or like a communistic type approach for music and monetary, repentance for musicians. So what you can do is sign up and say you're a musician and say that I deserve to get paid because I'm a musician. And, this is a special kind of talent that I have. And I deserve to get paid by the government because I can, hum a tune or play a guitar. And all those people out there who are enjoying music, have a right to pay me. They have a legal obligation to fund my music playing because I'm a special person and I can play music, is kind of what they're saying. And this is a very interesting kind of way of thinking about musicians. Now, if you think about it in the way of it's a public works, almost like, in Canada we have healthcare and everybody contributes to the healthcare, or, roads or police or firemen or things like that. It's, it's for the public, general public good. Now, what they're kind of going after is determining that music is a general public good, or movies are a general public good. And almost levying a tax on people because, just about everybody has a phone that can store music, or computers that can store music or movies, portable devices that can play movies or music back. And just about everybody has one of these devices. Most people have a cell phone in the world of, over 16 or something. And so what they're proposing is a taxed system where musicians automatically get paid by the government. So I wonder if you maybe have to sign up for, a contract or a legal form. You go to the government and you say, I would like to apply to be, a musician for the Canadian government. And then they can maybe go through your application. You can play some tunes for them. And once you get approved, you can start getting, checks in the mail. From the taxes that are collected from the general public. And maybe there's an allotment of certain number of musicians. Maybe 5 new musicians a year can sign on, or 10 new musicians a year can sign on. And, they take the roster of the 1,000 people right now, maybe top 1,000 selling Canadian musicians, and toss the rest off. And those top 1,000 can get paid from the government bankroll. So it's very, very interesting proposition they're trying to put forward. Now, I'm kind of being facetious because this has already been in effect since 1997. So it's been in effect for 13 years. Musicians have been automatically been sent checks by the government, not by the government, but the government passes it on, or the government has enacted these things. So when you buy a CD in the stores, a blank CD that, is designated audio on it, because they don't take the ones that don't say audio on it, but they're trying to repeal that and get that in line. So that even when you buy a hard drive, which could potentially store music on it, that a certain amount of money goes to SOCAN and some other organizations that can in turn distribute it to their top artists. So very interesting. So this has already been going on for 13 years and they just want to extend it. It says the other is a fair dealing motion, M506, that would allow reasonable use of copyrighted materials for innovation, research, and study. So on the other hand, what the citizens of Canada are gaining from this is that we are allowed to copy music and movies as much as we like, as long as you're not making money off of it. So it states 29, fair dealing of a copyrighted work for purposes such as research, private study, criticism, news reporting, or review is not an infringement of copyright. So if I play music on my new show here, I don't have to pay a dime, which, you know, has certain benefits to me. But on the other end, you have to pay a tax for this use of music. A mandatory tax. So very interesting. Angus says, after years of talk, it's time parliamentarians got serious about updating our copyright laws. Digital locks and suing fans are not going to prevent people from copying music from one form to another, he said. The levy is a solution that works. By updating it, we'll ensure that artists are getting paid for their work and that consumers aren't criminalized for moving their legally obtained music from one format to another. However, the renowned Canadian academic and law professor Michael Geist, through supportive of their fair dealing proposition, finds the iPod tax troubling. Why? Because the device definition is vague enough that it will also cover smartphones and PCs. Well, the CPCC, the Private Copying Collective, may not target all of these devices. There is nothing in the bill that prevents them from doing so. Geist also worries that since video recordings are not included, it can mean the introduction of a new tax at a later date, perhaps pushing it upwards of $100 or more. Most important of all, through a notable experiment, is the iPod tax would only cause consumers to purchase iPods and other devices covered by the tax outside of Canada where it didn't apply. As for how much, one could only guess, but last time it was in the $75 range. Yeah, last time when it was introduced or trying to be put through, it was like some of the taxes were actually more than the device actually cost. Nobody would in their right mind pay for it. It's unbelievable. The Canadian Private Copyright Collective has been pushing for a similar levy as far back as 2007, but those efforts were defeated early last year by the country's Federal Court of Appeals. Now in copyright news from the United Arab Emirates, Rupert Murdoch's son, P2P, likes stealing Pringles or a handbag. James Murdoch said there's no difference between digital and physical piracy, said there should be the same level of property rights whether it's a house or a movie. Well, at the same event, famed Hollywood talent agent Ari Emanuel said the industry is currently talking to President Obama about three strikes legislation. The recent Abu Dhabi media summit was every bit as entertaining as one would expect it to be when the entertainment industry heavyweights get together and plan strategies for new and improved get tough approach to piracy. First up was James Murdoch, son of media mogul Rupert Murdoch and chairman and chief executive of News Corporation's Europe and Asian operations. He compared online piracy to stealing a can of Pringles or a handbag, arguing that there's no difference between digital and physical piracy. There should be the same level of property rights, whether it's a house or a movie, he added. Murdoch is apparently unaware that the tremendous difference between a physical and digital piracy. The latter doesn't rob people of irreplaceable property, only possible profits. Copyright holders are still free to sell digital property as many times as they wish or can. In fact, numerous well-respected studies have found that illegal file sharing actually increases their ability to do so. But for Murdoch, that doesn't seem to matter. He wants law enforcement to target illegal file sharers as they would ordinary thieves. They should be at the same level of sanctity as there is around property. Content is no different. They're not crazy kids, he continues. No, punish them. Never mind the fact that there's no way to fight digital piracy short of DPI. A better alternative is simply to offer some sort of on-demand content delivery system that consumers crave and cause many to turn to P2P in the first place. People in Australia, for example, don't want to wait an extra year to watch episodes of Lost or Family Guy. They want to be able to tune in when people in the US can. P2P has democratized content delivery in the absence of legal alternatives. Ignoring this fact and branding what are ostensibly loyal viewers or fans as thieves only makes the problem worse. Also joining Murdoch at the event was Ari Emanuel, famed Hollywood talent agent and purported model for Ari Gold character in the hit HBO series Entourage. He followed by disclosing just what steps the industry planned to take in its fight against online piracy. We are in the midst of talking to the president and some attorney generals, and we're trying to implement a three strikes and you're out rule, he said. He alluded to the possible fight with ISPs over the matter, but apparently made no mention of the probable backlash by the American people. Unlike France or South Korea, where the people seem to take all too willing to give the government power to filter the internet and disconnect users suspected of illegal file sharing, the people of the US are going to be particularly leery of giving the government control of the internet, especially when it's disclosed it's only being done to benefit deep-pocketed entertainment industry heavyweights. Even though the President-elect Obama promised to protect the openness of the internet, having a VP who's a longtime entertainment industry advocate and is a co-founder of the Congressional International Anti-Piracy Caucus may prove too much to resist in the end. And he has just come out and said that he supports ACTA as well. How much longer is it going to be before he comes out and he approves and says, yep, three strikes and you're out. People in the U.S. get kicked off the internet after being accused three times of violating copyright and, you know, driving a car when these buggy and whip manufacturers are losing out big time because their business model is going the way of the dodo. And they're not innovating, they're just suing their fans rather than giving their fans what they want, which is easy, available access to the media. It's not that they don't want your media. They still do want your media. They're downloading it by the thousands. What they want is easy access to your media. What they want is it in a form that they can watch it on their computer, their television, their portable media device. You're not giving that to them. If you made it accessible from your website in an awesome form, in the perfect digital form where they can download it and get all the new movies instantly, in the easiest way possible, that they can just go to one repository, maybe you distribute it all over the internet to many different sites, you know, sites that sell it on behalf of you, you can make some money off of them rather than losing all the money to the torrent sites where people are turning to now because they can't get it in their format, because on DVD you've prevented them from copying it and put it onto their portable device, because on Blu-ray they can't even watch it if they don't have the proper television with the right little token constraints so that their screen doesn't go blank saying it's not the right compliant television. So they've got lessons to learn, and they'll learn it the hard way over time as more and more people oppose their plan of locking down the entertainment rather than delivering the entertainment to the masses. Copyright news from the U.S. concern as Lords pass digital economy bill to the Commons. The controversial digital economy bill has moved a step closer to becoming law after the House of Lords last night approved the proposals, but critics say the legislation is in danger of being rushed through Parliament. Despite reservations from a number of peers, the scheme, which includes the contentious three strikes rule to cut off internet access for alleged file sharers, will now be put before the MPs, with the government hoping that it can pass into the statute books before a general election is called. The bill contains a number of controversial aspects alongside three strikes, which could suspend broadband connections used by anybody accused of file sharing three times, whether or not they're convicted of copyright infringement. The notorious Clause 17, which now has in its scope diminished, has proposed to give Secretary of State the power to update copyright law without parliamentary assent. And the Liberal Democrats caused uproar when the proposed amendment to the bill apparently aimed at bringing more judicial oversight to the system, but critics could end up shutting down major websites such as YouTube. The change would give the High Court the power to shut down entire websites if they host substantial amounts of copyright-infringing materials. Come in for strong criticism, particularly after it emerged that the language used was identical to proposal by British music industry body, the BPI. As a result, the Liberal Democrats yesterday made the unusual step of tabling a charge of change of their own to the amendment in order to allay some of the concerns. The government, however, pushed that aside and said it would enact the changes itself in the wash-up process in the House of Commons in order to ensure that the bill continued its speedy passage through Parliament. So, it's one step closer to cutting off your internet in the UK. So, keep your friends and family informed of what this bill is about and its impact that it could have on your internet connection, whether it's you doing the infringement, or somebody's hacked into your computer, or your Wi-Fi, or your friend has come over, or who knows how the copyright infringement could be accused. But it's just an accusation. It's just that. It's not going to be proved in court. You're not going to go through any process. The person who holds the copyright is just going to send a letter to your ISP saying that you've infringed. What if you're on 2 out of 3? And somebody tries to spoof a letter to your ISP, and that's number 3, and you get kicked off. And you're off, and you need to do business, you need to do work, you need to do your school, and now you have no access because some corporation has said you've done something wrong, and now you have no access to the internet. What needs to happen is that there needs to be the internet declared something is an essential service, really. That's what it needs to be declared as people have the right to access information through the internet is become such a commonplace thing that everybody uses that you can't just cut off people's access to information because one aspect of it a corporation does not like. It's a bad idea that they're trying to put through right now, and they're just being lobbied to do it by corporations. How did corporations get this big? I don't know. How did they get this much power over a seemingly unrelated business? Internet access is beyond me. They fight it tooth and nail. They don't understand it, and they're trying to get rid of it any way they can. They'd be happy if the internet was never invented and everyone went back to physical copies of CDs and DVDs, and digital copies didn't exist, and you put them in your player, and they never came out again, and your friends couldn't even borrow them. Because that is your DVD, not for lending, not for anything else. Heck, they'd love it if it went back before there was even DVDs, and they went back to something that was... movies were only in the theater, and only you could see it if you paid the admission. You couldn't watch it over and over again at home? That's crazy. They fought tooth and nail against VCRs, and now they're making more money than ever through DVD sales. And even in theaters, they're making more money than ever, and they complain that they're losing money. Losing money from where? Losing money that people don't have? It's unbelievable. Next story, copyright news from the EU. Bogus piracy report misleads EU legislators. And I think this is the one that has some information. This very interesting statement at the end of this. A new report commissioned by the Creative Industries claims that piracy could result in £240 billion euros in lost revenue and 1.2 million job losses by 2015. By selective use of sources and shoddy research techniques, lobbyists hope that the report will open the doors to tougher anti-piracy laws. The entertainment industry is known to commission reports and research that hugely benefits their lobbying practices. A new report, Building a Digital Economy, was released yesterday. This report investigates the impact of piracy on Europeans' creative sector and was paid for by the same industry. As expected, the report paints a disastrous picture. In just 5 years from now, the total cost of lost jobs in Europe could grow to 1.2 million, and the lost revenue for the industry may skyrocket to 240 billion euros in the same time frame. The report was quickly praised by anti-piracy outfits, including the BPI and IFPI, who will use it in their political lobbying efforts. Of course, those who took the time to look at the report will have seen that there are many assumptions and statistical tricks that led to the outrageous claims. We'll discuss a few of them below and show that depending on what the sources are used, one could come to an entirely different conclusion. The report suggests that there's a direct correlation between internet traffic growth and lost jobs. That is, the more traffic that is generated on the internet, the more money will be lost. This correlation is one, according to the report, which assumes that all growth in internet traffic will increase piracy at the same rate. Obviously, these people have never heard about correlation and causation. Even if that is even relevant in this case, just because that is how the graph has gone, doesn't mean that how it'll go in the future. The report makes another bogus assumption that by stating that more traffic will mean more piracy, thus more lost revenue. It does not account for the fact that people might consume higher quality of files, which are greater in file size, and all projections are based on bandwidth and not the number of pirated goods. And it also, and I'm just going to add a note, that it doesn't take into account legal file sharing and legal sources of downloads. It's not doing statistic analysis on what exactly is being downloaded. Does this include iTunes and Netflix streaming downloads, watching movies legally that you paid for? I doubt it. It's just looking at basic numbers, assuming that everything is pirated, everything across the internet is copyright infringement. It goes on and on about all the different assumptions that it's made. You can check it out for yourself. It goes to the bottom. The claimed losses of 12... I'll go up one. I'm fed up with hearing corporate propaganda being deployed in order to justify intrusions on our rights and freedoms of speech, privacy, and to a fair trial. Jim Killock, executive director of the Open Rights Group, said in a comment on the report. The claimed losses of £1,200 per household in the UK are clearly ludicrous. I certainly don't know anyone who has an extra £1,200 in their pockets thanks to piracy. Pirate Party leader, UK Pirate Party leader Andrew Robinson added. The entertainment industry lobby, however, has already managed to get support from various politicians in the EU Parliament and will continue to use the report to justify their call for tougher measures against online piracy. We can only hope that the majority of them will see through the misleading setup and bogus numbers. And one last story, a good story, free culture news from Germany. Several libraries in Germany make their bibliographic data open access. This time, both public and academic libraries in Cologne, Germany, our area, are offering cataloging data. From the announcement, Cologne-based libraries in the Library Center of Rhineland-Palatinate, in cooperation with the North Rhine-Westphalian Library Service Center, and the first German libraries to adopt the idea of open access for bibliographic data by publishing their catalog data for free for public use. The University and Public Library of Cologne, USB, the Library of Academia Media Arts Cologne, and the University Library of University of Applied Science of Cologne and the LBZ are taking the lead by releasing their data. The Public Library of Cologne is announced to follow shortly. The release of bibliographic data forms a basis for linking that data with the data from other domains in the semantic web. So good on the libraries of Cologne for releasing some of the library data for everyone to share in. Now some events and Pirate Party news. Technology law expert Michael Geist heads down under. Canadian law professor Michael Geist will be the keynote speaker at Internet New Zealand's Public ACTA event that will be held in Wellington on the 10th of April. So if you're in New Zealand listening to this, this will be an amazing event to go to, considering that New Zealand has just passed some internet filtering. And I'm sure he'll speak on that, and he'll speak on the ACTA, which is the main thing that they're talking about. Ahead of multinational meeting on the controversial anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, ACTA is being negotiated in secret by the USA, EU, Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and other countries. It aims to increase the control intellectual property owners have over their products and ideas and to reduce counterfeiting and the illegal trade in counterfeit goods. However, a series of leaks has raised concerns that the original brief of the pact has been expanded to include online file sharing and copying and could require policies such as internet disconnection to be applied by states that sign up to the accord. New Zealand has emerged as a leading global voice on ACTA, and I'm delighted to have the chance to participate in this important event, Geist says in a statement released by Internet NZ. Many people around the world have watched with admiration how thousands of New Zealanders have actively engaged in domestic and international copyright reform initiatives, promoting a balanced approach that meets the needs of all stakeholders. Geis, the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, Canada, has written widely on the challenges of copyright and digital technology. So that's something you don't want to miss if you live in New Zealand. And there's a Pirate Party of Canada meeting on March 19th, which is tomorrow from this date. Today's Thursday. Tomorrow's Friday, March 19th, so it's tomorrow. Vancouver's first 2010 meeting will be held at the Pirate Party of Canada's Western Headquarters on March 19th. The meeting will begin at 7 p.m., and everybody is welcome. That's a message from Jake Danes, the leader of the Pirate Party of Canada. So if you're in British Columbia or Vancouver, head on down to that. I've linked the Facebook event there, so you can check that out and let them know that you're coming. And from Pirate Party Ireland, IRCOM's Pirate Bay ban criminalizes community media. This is from the Irish Pirate Party website. The Irish Pirate Party noted with concern today that some of the damaging effects of IRCOM's September 2009 ban on allowing its customers access to the global file sharing site, the Pirate Bay. The original IRCOM decision arose as a result of pressure from IRMA, Irish Recorded Music Association, and its attempts to stop illegal file music sharing. Yet, as the Pirate Party pointed out at the time, there were bound to be consequent damage limitations placed on the ability of other independent artists, musicians, and filmmakers to legally distribute their work. As of last week, the Pirate Party noted with alarm that one such case has already arisen with the Dublin Community Television's recent release of the Pedal Project. Among the list of Pedal Project partners are such unlikely intellectual property violators, such as Smarter Travel, the Department of Transport, Dublin City Council, and Dublin Cycling Campaign, and the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. The Dublin Community Television itself is a small community station based out of the Liberties. According to its websites, they broadcast a wealth of innovative, creative, and critical programs that focus on real people and communities over Digital Chorus, UPC Channel 802, and then to the rest of the country through online streams and downloads. On the DC TV site, they called the Pedal Project the most complete and wide-ranging analysis of cycling in Dublin yet. The series consists of three fast-paced and tightly cut edgy documentaries and alongside a number of comedy sketches. The series also features a startling soundtrack of Irish underground electronic producers and musicians from a diverse range of net labels. A spokesperson for the Pirate Party stated, "It's outrageous that such a valuable and poorly resourced community media groups like Dublin Community TV now face having distribution of their work truncated by the ill-thought-out consequences of an IRCOM ban that criminalizes one particular method of file sharing, regardless of what content is being shared. The case serves an illustrative how backward and ill-informed Irish intellectual property laws and the drastic need for intermediate reform. It also illustrates a sharp divide between how smaller media makers and artists are usually global file sharing networks to get their work out there. And totally opposing group actions of group like IRCON and IRMA that want a lockdown on the means by which they can do this. Often, as we see here, the ones that get it in the neck are cash-starved groups like DCTV that use innovative means to broadcast their work." So what they were doing was releasing their work from this local community station on the Pirate Bay, which is now banned in Ireland through IRCOM's work. So they can't get their information out anymore. Now, personally, I also used the Pirate Bay for distributing my torrents for my work as well, which I allowed. And now some people in the world, such as the people in Ireland, cannot download it through the torrents. And it's very disappointing that they can't see the good through the other stuff that's on there. They can't see that this is a tool and it's not something that needs to be banned. It needs to be embraced and worked upon so that you can use it for the public good. It is just a tool. You can put whatever you want on it. Now, speaking of tools, free pirate tools. Now, here's a article about how to wipe your hard drive, SSDs, and thumb drives clean. It's called Leave No Trace. is from Gizmodo, with stories abounding of identity theft aided by information lifted from discarded storage devices. You want devices you no longer plan to use to have no usable information when they head out the door. Here's how to wipe them clean. Why erasing files is not enough. Sure, you could erase the contents of the drive, but keep this in mind. The act of erasing a file does not remove it from a storage device. So it goes on to talk about the different types of storage devices, the different methods of wiping clean and erasing or overwriting the data on the drive so that none of your important data can fall into somebody else's hands when you're done with a hard drive or a piece of media. So very interesting read. Take a look through it. They analyze the different methods and come up with their own conclusions on which way is the best to dispose of your important data. And hopefully a lot of companies and governments also take a look at these kinds of methods, because so many times I've read about people buying hard drives at flea markets and auctions, getting them home, and the data is not even wiped off the drive, or it's sitting in a recycle bin, or it's sitting in something else that's easily obtainable, and you can take a look through records, private records that should never fall in the hands of anybody other than the person who has it. So the trust does not just go to the governments, but what they do with the data after it. They may keep it secure while it's on site, but once it's off site, where does it go? Now, in the free media and music section, music from Magnitude. Now, I'm talking about free as in freedom here. Music from Magnitude. This is from creativecommons.org. We've been following Magnitude since its launch in 2003 as a record label that embraced the net, including giving fans the legal right to do what comes naturally, share a remix musically, not remix music non-commercially, by offering all label music under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license, which is also what I operate under with all of my media that I put out. I don't have any on Magnitude, but I'm going to be taking a look at it soon. As at the time, a very radical position. Fast forward nearly 7 years to Magnitude founder John Buckman's update on the label's business. So really, it's not that much we're changing business models, but rather we introduced an unlimited membership 2 years ago. They've been so successful, we decided to focus on that. Some things that we're not changing. We're still not evil. We've always paid 50% of membership fees to our musicians, been DRM-free, and use Creative Commons licensing. All that stays the same. We'll continue selling commercial use licenses of our music, though in a few months we'll be moving that business to a new music licensing website we're building. So it's great that people can go to this website, take a look through it, and buy blanket licenses they can use this great music in their products. Or you can go and pay a monthly fee and download all the music that you like from the website. This is people that get the idea. They don't use any DRM. You're able to transport this music to any device that you have, so you can listen to it on the go, on your portable music device, on your telephone, on your computer, anywhere you want. Now, it's closing track and closing words, The Right to Read by Richard Stallman. I played that at the end of the show last week, the thing I recorded, the little piece of audio. I've actually posted a YouTube video of it, of me reading it with the words along on the screen, so you can take a look at that. I've linked it. And the music at the end of this show, it's called Home Taping is Killing Music, by our friend Dan Bull, who's come up with another great music. So it sounds cheesy because it's a throwback to the 80s, when the music industry thought that cassette tapes were going to kill the music industry because you could copy onto them and just record music and nobody would ever buy it again. Well, they were wrong in the past about VCRs, they were wrong in the past about cassette tapes, and they're wrong again about digital media. People are buying digital media. They just want it in the right form. If you give it in the right form, they will buy it. And this was done, this song was done for the Don't Disconnect Us campaign in opposition to the digital economy bill being proposed in Britain. So take a look at their website for some great information on what the digital economy bill is all about. It's at don'tdisconnect.us. Don't disconnect us. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local pirate party and find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms in this digital age. If you have news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com, submit them through the form on the website so I can know all about them and keep up to date and keep everyone up to date on what's going on. Thank you for listening. Until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Tracks he plays.
Home taping is killing music.